Welcome to today's Voices of Conservation Science. On this podcast, we talk to people that are doing science that's then used to conserve natural resources. I'm your host, Andrea Litt. And my guest today is Ian Anderson, who's a graduate student at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. Welcome, Ian. Thanks for joining us today.
How's your day going?
Going great. We're finally getting some great weather here in Montana. And I should say we're in what we're calling Studio Zoom, which means that Ian and I are in different places staying safe during the pandemic. And actually, Ian is broadcasting from his field site, which we'll get into more later. So kind of a unique situation to be doing a podcast about natural resources when you're actually in the field getting to do that work. So thanks for joining.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Ian, I want to start our conversation by having you introduce yourself to our audience.
Okay, yeah, my name is Ian Anderson. I'm a graduate student at Montana State University in Bozeman, where I am working towards my master's degree in fish and wildlife management. I grew up in central Illinois, sort of doing all the normal outdoorsy things that people in this field say they did when they grew up. So lots of fishing, just sort of, you know, exploring the local ponds and lakes and streams and things like that. And I definitely started getting interested in biology and ecology, wildlife biology, throughout junior high and high school, and was able to attend University of Montana, which is in Missoula, Montana. And I majored in wildlife biology there, where I received my bachelor's. And sort of bounced around working fisheries jobs for a few more summers after I graduated there in 2016. And then, yeah, made my way back to Montana, where I'm at MSU right now and working under my advisor, Alexander Zale.
That's very cool. So lots of steps along that path. I want to back up and talk about a few of them. So you're in central Illinois and hanging out outside, like you said, like lots of people on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned something that it caught my attention. You said that as early as junior high and high school, you had a sense that you wanted to sort of pursue or at least major in, and then obviously potentially pursue a career in sort of fisheries and or in wildlife or natural resources. And how do you think you were able to do that so quickly? That is not something that everybody on this podcast.
Honestly, looking back, there weren't many things that really interested me in school. I was always really good in school. You know, I put a lot of time and effort into it, but I just enjoyed how much time I spent outside. I really liked learning about all the species that I would catch at the pond behind my house. And my mom and dad definitely sort of encouraged me to explore that route. My mom had done some biology and zoology work when she was a bachelor student back in the 80s. And so she sort of pushed me in that direction. And I definitely noticed, you know, even in junior high and high school, my favorite classes were always the science classes, the biology classes. And from that point on, I, you know, there wasn't really much else on my mind after I realized that you could work outdoors with all these species, and it just seemed like the thing for me to do.
That realization that your hobby and the thing that you love to do when you recreate and that you can translate that into a career is, I think, a pretty big hurdle to get over. And so it's cool that you had your mom that, and I'm sure other people that helped you see that it wasn't just a fun thing to do in the afternoons or on the weekends or whatever, but that you could really make a career of it. The other thing you mentioned earlier was that you were in Illinois and then all of a sudden you ended up in Montana. So how did you decide to make the trek to Montana after high school?
Well, I guess it all started when my family and I did sort of like the Great American Road Trip. a couple different summers. One summer we went out to Colorado, and then the next summer we went out to Yellowstone, and then we drove through Montana on our way to Glacier National Park. And at that point, that was the first time I'd really, that and the year before were the first times I'd really seen the Rockies. And the fact that you could live out here and go to school out here, I was just like, man, why wouldn't I try to do this?
It was all over for the Midwest.
Yeah, no offense to my friends that, you know, still live in Illinois, but as soon as I saw the mountains and the rivers, I was like, man, I got to try to get out here. And so I sort of made it a goal of mine to apply to some schools in the Rocky Mountain West. And yeah, my mom had previously gone to University of Montana for just 1 year of grad school. So she really liked Missoula and encouraged me to apply there. And I ended up getting in, and I got a scholarship that would, you know, at least give me the ability to go out there. So yeah, it was a big leap, definitely a lot different than Central Illinois. But yeah, I'm really, really happy I did it.
It is pretty transformational once you see those mountains for the first time, at least for many of us, because I have a similar memory the first time sort of heading west and realizing that the landscape looked really different than I was used to growing up.
Exactly. Yeah. Where did you grow up, Andrea? Just really quick.
I grew up in Wisconsin, so I have a similar Midwestern roots. And there are a lot of us displaced Midwesterners here in Montana.
Yeah, particularly people from Wisconsin, I've noticed. That's funny.
Yes, it's true. It is true. You mentioned also that you you had some other jobs, and I'm curious if you'll take us through at least a few of the species or places where you did some of that work.
Yeah, sure. After my freshman year at University of Montana, I was still sort of undecided whether I would go into the wildlife realm or the fisheries realm. And I ended up just applying to this internship up near Glacier National Park, working with native West Slope cutthroat trout and invasive rainbow trout. And I just sort of happened to apply for it at the perfect time. And the person who ended up hiring me was in Missoula at the time. So it just sort of worked out that we were able to meet. And so I ended up working after my freshman year up there in Glacier National Park. And then after that, I was able to work down in Dillon, Montana, and the Centennial Valley with the native Arctic grayling population. And the year after that, I did some similar work in the same area. And then for the 3 years afterwards, I sort of did a big transition where I moved to the desert southwest and was able to work with some really cool native desert fishes on some of the bigger rivers down there, particularly the San Juan River and the Colorado River.
You've worked in some beautiful, beautiful places and on some interesting species. I've spent a fair bit of time in the Centennial Valley, and clearly you got to revisit the Glacier National Park after going out there on your epic road trip. And then, yeah, I think a lot of people forget about the fisheries and water resources in the Southwest because of thinking more about the desert. So that sounds like you've had a very interesting journey and path.
Yeah, I cannot complain about the places I've been able to work. It's kind of been a dream.
Yeah. And earlier you talked about your mom, you know, because of her path being a little bit similar to yours, at least for a while, mm-hmm. I'm guessing she was pretty instrumental in getting you interested in conservation. Is that true?
Yeah. Sorry, Andrea. I'm assuming you were talking about my mom there. The internet cut out for a second.
No worries. Yeah, I'm just curious about people that were instrumental for you in getting you interested in conservation or in the profession in general.
Yeah, I would say my mom was a really big player. And like I said, she sort of had the same career path as me. She actually did her undergrad back in Illinois in the 80s, and she attended University of Montana as a grad student for just 1 year in the wildlife bio program. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to finish. So since then, she sort of encouraged me, you know, if you have the option to do this and the opportunity presents itself, You know, not many people can say that they work as a wildlife biologist in Montana. So if that's what you want to do, you should go for it and try as hard as you can to get those sorts of jobs. And then there were a couple really instrumental, I guess, other fisheries biologists that I worked with or for the first couple years I was out in Montana. Ryan Kovach was one of them. And then Matt Yeager, who now works in Dillon for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And they, you know, love their jobs. They had a fantastic time in the field. And they were just, I just really respected them as biologists. And I thought it would be great to help the resource like they helped the resource.
That's great. It is really a rewarding profession to be in when you get to interact with those people that are so passionate about what they do. And then obviously that translates to you and your passion for what you're doing. And yeah, it's very, very cool to have been motivated by these excited folks.
Mm-hmm.
What hurdles have you encountered along your path? It sounds like, you know, with kind of figuring out pretty early on the path you wanted to head down and then deciding on fisheries shortly thereafter, you know, often that for many people, that's the big challenge is figuring out that you can actually do this for a job. That sounds like it wasn't a hurdle for you. Have there been other hurdles that you've encountered along the way?
Boy, I would say it's the process of moving from undergraduate schooling and then, you know, finding some solid fisheries technician jobs and then trying to transition into graduate school. That was actually really tough. And I think it is for a lot of people. It's such a competitive field to be able to find a graduate position that interests you and then that you're actually able to get. So I was really, really, really fortunate to get this one here at MSU. And I think that sort of transition from a technician job into grad school or trying to find a permanent job is what drives a lot of people away from this profession, because it is really, really hard to make that transition successfully. And I definitely have a lot of friends who they sort of reached the point where it was no longer worth it for them to work those 3 to 9 months technician jobs. And it just got to be too much. And they sort of moved on to other professions. But I was really lucky in that I was able to make that transition within a couple years of when I started trying. So that would probably be the biggest hurdle for me. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That we this come up on this podcast often about how competitive it is. And although talking about that, I think is important because it's the reality of things. You're absolutely right that can dissuade some people from you know, continuing or continuing to look for those positions or continuing to apply to graduate school. And so it's hard to get the jobs in the first place, and then hard to translate that experience into a graduate position. So I'm curious, now that you have secured this this graduate position and you're working towards your degree, might you have any advice for those people that might be listening that are feeling frustrated and thinking it's just never going to happen, or things that might help people be successful or how to stay positive in a in an environment that might discourage that?
Boy, I guess I just got lucky in a lot of ways, but I would still say just like checking those job and like graduate school websites, checking them religiously every single day. I got really lucky in that I just happened to find a few of these positions honestly moments after they were posted. And when you get your name out there right away, that really helps. And I would say another thing is if you can take some jobs, you know, in different places, try to meet as many people as possible. I was able to meet a lot of people both in Western Montana, Southwestern Montana, and then down in the desert in, you know, the Colorado River drainage. A lot of the people I just met through happenstance on some river trips were pretty instrumental in me getting jobs in the future. So yeah, this is sort of a cop-out answer, but you know, network.
But it's realistic, absolutely.
I mean, everybody says it and there's a reason. So I would say never stop looking for jobs, because there might be something that just pops up that you looks like, you know, your dream job. And then just, yeah, try to talk to as many people as you can.
And I think that, that's also great advice and not at all a cop out, because it is definitely about building your network. And also along that way, you gain some additional skills, and just the more people that know about you and your abilities and your qualities that you can bring to the job, you know, the more people are going to have you on their brains when a position really does come available, or who can speak to your character and your abilities when a graduate position opens up. So I think both the staying on top of the postings for jobs and for graduate positions, and then continuing to build that network, as frustrating as that may be, I think those are great pieces of advice. I'm curious what you think your path is after graduate school, because clearly you thought graduate school was a necessary and important step for you, because you weathered the storm to get here. What do you think is in store for you afterwards, which I know might be down the way, but what are you hoping for in terms of a job?
Yeah, maybe I should have included this in the hurdles part. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that's sort of exciting, I think, still, is that I know I want to stay in the profession, but I still don't really know where I'd like to end up or what exactly I'd like to end up doing. But I think in general, if I could get some sort of position working for a state fish and wildlife agency as either a fisheries conservation research biologist or a fisheries manager, I think that would be really rewarding in a lot of ways. And another thing I've been thinking about is, like I said, I've worked with both state and federal agencies, and a lot of federal agencies have some really, really cool field-based positions that are all research-based, which I think would also just be amazing to do, at least for, you know, the coming years while I'm still relatively young. And then it seems like the trajectory is, you know, people move up the ladder and they start getting more involved with planning and management, and that all would be really interesting to do too, because you get to see a lot of different aspects of this profession that you wouldn't get to if you were in the field all the time.
Absolutely. No, it might be a hurdle to figure out, but I also think that that's a great thing to have all these possibilities out there for you, and that you can be thinking about as you pursue your degree and even after. It's perfectly reasonable to pursue one thing, and then, like you said, maybe as the position changes or as your experience changes, you move into some different kind of capacity. So that's all very exciting.
Exactly, yeah.
You're listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science, and today I'm talking with Ian Anderson, a graduate student at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. So Ian, I want to shift gears here and move towards talking about your research, since we've got you here talking to us from the field. I think it's pretty apropos to now transition to that. So give us a little bit of an overview about your research.
I am working on the Yellowstone River currently.
Absolutely, right, currently.
as we speak. I'm actually monitoring the effectiveness of a nature-like fishway or a nature-like bypass channel that goes around a diversion dam on the Yellowstone River down near Billings, Montana. So it's in the, I guess you would call it like the transitional zone or the central Yellowstone River or the middle Yellowstone River. And what I'm doing is, this diversion dam is known to be at least a partial barrier to fish moving throughout the Yellowstone River system. So we are catching, 4,000 fish in 2 years of this study. And we're tagging them with these pit tags, which are passive integrated transponder tags. So we put these tags in all these fish species, and then we release the fish, and we're hopefully tracking their movement throughout this nature-like fishway as they move up and down it to get around this diversion dam. So we're hoping to figure out what species are using this fishway and if the fishway is actually effective or not. So are fish able to successfully get around this dam using this fish passage structure?
All right, very cool stuff. And I wanna break down and go back and talk about a few pieces of that so that I make sure I understand. So you talked about sort of a fishway or a fish passage structure. And then you mentioned that the one you're looking at is a nature-like fishway. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what these fish passage structures might look like in general, and then what makes yours a nature-like fishway?
Yeah, so we're all familiar with, the large dams that we see on some of the rivers out west and out east and all over the world, actually. And people call them fish ladders most often, but I guess I call them fishways. It's just any sort of structure that is built to allow fish to move upstream past the dam or back downstream. And fish ladders are probably the most common design that you think of, and they sort of resemble like a staircase of cascading pools of water that really strong swimming species can use to sort of jump over from one pool to the next and eventually get up and over a really large diversion or a dam. But this one that I'm studying is a nature-like fishway, so it has a much lower slope, and it's actually built to be much longer than some of those really steep fish ladders that you think about. And nature-like fishways are really cool because they sort of are built to resemble a natural stream or a side channel, and they're sort of interspersed with boulders or rocks or logs or any sort of material. And it's obviously because of that that they're called nature-like. And the idea behind these nature-like fishways is that since they are built to resemble a natural stream channel, they should allow all sorts of fish species and other aquatic species to pass them, not just the really, really strong swimming ones.
Gotcha. So the potential benefits of this particular type is that it could make the passage a lot easier for lots of species of fish, and therefore restore the connectivity across the river where you're working.
Exactly. And that's really important on the Yellowstone. I think there are about 30 fish species in the area I'm working. And, we want all of these to be able to pass this structure. There are some invasive species present in the area, but they're actually present above and below the diversion. So our goal with this nature-like fishway is to tag as many of these species as possible and then, try to figure out if they can get up or down past this diversion.
So, yeah, you said you were looking at the effectiveness of this particular fishway, and you define that as their ability to get over that that potential or partial barrier. And you talked about these pit tags that you're using to mark the fish. So once you tag the fish and release them, how will you know whether they successfully get over that partial barrier?
Yeah, so these pit tags are really cool in that they aren't actually charged and they don't have any sort of battery. So they just sit in the fish. And what happens is we constructed these pit antennas, or these passive integrated transponder antennas, which are just loops of wire that we put in the fishway, in the nature-like fishway. And as the fish swims over this antenna, swims over this wire, just for the millisecond that it swims over it, that tag is charged and then simultaneously sends the code back to the antenna. So we can detect the exact moment each tagged fish passes one of those antennas. So what you do is you just put your antennas at really strategic locations. So for instance, we have one at the very bottom at the attraction flow for the fishway. And then we have an antenna at the entrance. And then we have one at the exit. So if you detect a fish that moves from the attraction, then to the entrance, and then to the exit, you know that that fish passed. But if you detect it moving upstream and then you detect it moving back downstream, you can sort of assume that it failed because it was moving back downstream immediately. So it's all about positioning these antennas really strategically. And yeah, it's a really, really simple design. Obviously, it's much more complicated in the field, but it really gives you the ability to learn some cool things about how these fish are moving and if they're able to pass or not.
That's really cool. I mean, essentially, that means you're collecting data all the time.
Yes, it's constant. And I mean, I have over 12,000 detections of these fish right now, and I get more and more every day. So I'm really, really fortunate with the amount of data I'm collecting on this project. It's pretty incredible.
That's really very cool. But you also mentioned that you have to tag 4,000 fish in order to get all those data points. So it doesn't come for free by any means.
Yeah. I think we have tagged, we've tagged maybe 3,500 fish so far of 14 study species. And this has been obviously the fun part of the field work is getting out on the river and trying to capture these fish. So yeah, we've been using electrofishing methods out of an electrofishing boat. We've been drifting trammel nets in order to catch certain species, and we've been setting hoop nets in order to catch certain species. And right, the goal is to have 4,000 total tagged by the end of this 2-year study. So we're about 500 tags short right now, but I think we'll get there here in a few months.
Wow, that's really cool. And each of those methods you mentioned sort of targets or helps you catch a different suite of fish sizes and species. And so that allows you to get this big diversity of shapes and sizes and behaviors that will allow you to have really pretty impressive inference about how effective this nature-like fishway really is for not just a subset of species. So that's really very cool.
Yeah, and that's one of the really awesome things about this project is that hopefully what we learn will be able to be applied to many other systems that have, you know, not the whole suite and assemblage of species that the Yellowstone does, but fish that are similar to those here on the Yellowstone. So people in other places can try to design better or more effective fishways.
Yeah, and that's really important and impressive too, because it means that your work has the potential to provide some guidance and inform work that could be done elsewhere, and it's a really broad applicability of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I was so drawn to this position originally when I saw it, because it has such wide management implications, and I love the idea that my hard work and effort for these number of years will hopefully, you know, go towards the better good of conservation in, you know, fisheries conservation in the rest of the country.
Some of the best parts of our job is how rewarding they can be when those kinds of experiences happen. So that's very, really very cool.
Yeah,
you mentioned
for sure.
That, so we talked about you being in the field right now, and I'm guessing that means you're catching fish. Is that what you're doing right now?
Yeah, I am catching fish, not at the moment.
that's good for us.
Yeah, good. We've been out about 3 to 4 days a week for the last couple months now. And yeah, we've had really, really good luck. And we've caught and tagged, I think, almost 1,400 fish in the last couple months of, I think, 13 species. So it was really good that we were able to get out here in the spring to implant these tags in all these different species before they start migrating. So hopefully when they do migrate and attempt to move upstream, we'll be able to detect them moving through the fishway.
You'll be ready. Cool.
I'll be very ready.
And for our listeners, if they haven't seen one of these pit tags before, can you describe the size and shape of these things?
Yeah, they can be a range of sizes, but they're generally pretty small, especially compared to some of the other tags that you think about going on or in fish or wildlife. I actually have two sizes that I'm using. One is only 12 millimeters long, and you could fit it on your pinky nail. And then the other is about 32 millimeters long. That's got to be about as wide as your thumb.
Yeah.
A bit wider, and they're
a little wider.
All cylindrical tags, so they're able to be really easily implanted in these fish, and it's pretty safe actually, and not very hazardous to the fish at all.
So the smaller ones, I'm imagining kind of a grain of rice on my pinky there. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think I heard this correctly, Andrea.
Grain of rice.
Yeah, grain of rice, maybe a little bit bigger than a grain of rice. And those are the tags, those really, really small ones. Those are the ones that we put in the smaller fish, obviously.
Yeah.
And then the bigger fish get the bigger tags.
So now you're sitting at, I think you said 3,500 fish, and with hopefully some more to come, and getting ready for these fish to start doing their movements and the data to come raining in. What's the best thing you think you could discover at the end of all this?
Oh boy. I hope to discover that this fishway is working as it's built right now. I guess equally, it would be really nice to discover that it's not, so that we can actually take some actions to fix it. And I hope to just really get some good information about, you know, how many fish are succeeding versus how many are failing and how long it's taking them, because we know migrations are very time sensitive. So even if a high number of these or a high proportion of fish are making it, if it's taking them forever to find the entrance and eventually pass, it's not actually that effective of a fishway. So I'm hoping I can discover, yeah, whether this fishway in particular is effective and whether it's working, and then about all the other species we're studying, how well they can use it and how those fishways in some other areas could be improved based on what I find.
And clearly, and the idea of dams and other kinds of barriers are a really prominent feature on our landscape that aren't necessarily going anywhere anytime soon. So like you said, any information you can gain is going to be beneficial, whether this one works or whether you can tweak it to make it more effective. That's really very exciting stuff, Ian.
Thanks. Yeah. And there's been this idea sort of bouncing around in the fish passage literature lately about trying to make fishways so effective that they become sort of transparent on the landscape. And I think that's really cool. I think it's possible. We just have to, you know, do some more of these studies and try to report our results as efficiently to these other researchers as we can, so they can work on their own problems.
Yeah, decisions based in data. I love it. As we wrap up these podcasts, we ask our interviewees about their favorite animal or their favorite plant. So what is that for you?
This was a tough one. This is kind of bad because I'm in Montana now working, but I'll have to go back to my desert days and say the Colorado pike minnow. They're this huge, they're actually the largest minnow in North America. They migrate like almost thousands of kilometers to reach spawning areas. They can live up to 50 years old. I was able to work with them down in Colorado and Utah, and I'm assuming it's how people feel when they catch a sturgeon or something like
with
that.
With a minnow.
Yeah, but it's a minnow. It's you got to look up a picture of it now. But it's, I've sampled one when I was down in Colorado. I was able to net one that was 35 inches. And there's evidence that they used to reach up to 70 inches long, which is like almost 6 feet long.
Holy cow.
Yeah, incredible. And the first time I was ever holding one of those, just knowing that this fish that I was holding was like 30 plus years old and it's been all over the Southwest. And man, yeah, that's a cool feeling. And that's sort of really, that's what got me into movement ecology, because those fish migrate for such long distances and they're often blocked by dams. So, that sort of got me interested in dams and fish passage structures, which sort of led me to apply to where I am now at MSU.
Sounds like you are in exactly the place you need to be. That is very cool. How your work allows us to get this glimpse of these movements that, you know, I think we don't really get to witness too often. You know, we see the terrestrial migrations of bird species that are migrating, these big long distance movements, but much harder to witness. And so you're getting some firsthand look at some of these cool movements.
Well, yeah. Ian,
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. I was just going to say, that's one of the things that really interests me. And it's sort of a shame that people don't realize how many of these fish are moving hundreds of kilometers, hundreds of miles sometimes. And just to be able to show that they move from below a dam to above a dam is really important for the public to see.
Well, and if your enthusiasm isn't infectious about this, I don't know what would be. Well, Ian, thanks so much for taking the time out of your field work day to talk with me today, to tell me about your path and your work. And I really wish you the best of luck. Wrapping up the field season, getting those extra 500 or more fish, and with your work at MSU.
Thanks, Andrea. Yeah, this was really fun, and I appreciate it, and I hope you're staying safe where you're at.
Well, thanks. Same to you. And thanks to all of our listeners for listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with a friend. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. We'd also love to hear from you. You can leave us a review or email us with any of your thoughts about the podcast or questions for any of our guests at todaysvoices@montana.edu.